In this, the latest episode of the podcast, I have a really good conversation about stuff, mainly governance related, with Louise Nadal, secretary at the London School of Economics. We learn about Louise's career journey, which started with a series of short-term roles in London universities, culminating in a role in HR at Imperial College, at which point she realised she wanted to work closer to the core academic operation, so moved to a role in planning instead. Not long after starting this job at Royal Holloway, she also acquired governance responsibilities for the first time, and this pattern repeated a few years later when she joined Sussex University. Following this stint in planning and governance, Louise moved back to London as University Secretary at the University of East London before moving to a similar role at Greenwich and then to her current position at LSE. Governance then has been omnipresent in Louise's working life for many years now, and she argues that not only could it be considered sexy, the connections with strategy and planning are particularly relevant. We look at the key role played by members of governing bodies, how to get the best out of governors, and how important it was for them to develop a good understanding of the academic enterprise. Academic governance is identified by Louise as a concept which is often not well understood, and she provides some helpful direction. Exploring the nature of the role of secretary, Louise articulates the value of being able to see how everything fits together across the whole of a university, and how this helps the secretary protect the institution. More broadly, we consider external challenges, from industrial action to new free speech regulation, and why universities seem to be easy targets these days. Finally, Louise entertainingly contrasts the higher purpose of many university staff with their ability to waste hours debating the minutiae of issues such as car parking and institutional nomenclature. I do hope you enjoy it. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time it's my huge pleasure to introduce Louise Nadal, who is secretary at the London School of Economics. Hello, Louise.
Hello, Paul.
We're very excited to be talking today, and I really want to get straight into to understand a bit about your background and how you ended up at the LSE. So how did your career in university administration and management begin then? What drew you to the sunlit uplands that is university management?
A number of coincidences, really. So I had a very short-lived job at the University of London in their school's examining board in a temporary capacity. And I thought, well, I need something that's got a bit more of a career structure and a bit of a future. So that's how I ended up going to university. So it was a bit of a baptism of fire, I suppose. My first job was in academic timetabling. And in my first week, somebody told me it was the worst job in the university. And somebody else said, you must have done something awful in a previous life to have ended up here doing this. So it could only get better from there on, although perversely, I quite enjoyed it. But I then I did that just for a year, and then I moved into academic quality assurance. I did that for a few. So I was based in registries to begin with. And I worked at a medical school, which taught me how the NHS works and not to be scared of doctors. And then I went to Imperial and worked in HR, which was a bit of a quantum leap. Backroom stuff primarily, but very interesting. That pulled quite quickly, actually, because Imperial is an amazing place, but I felt I could have been working anywhere. HR wasn't the right environment for me. It didn't feel like any kind of connection to the academy, which is what I was used to. So in another, it sounds like quite drastic bolt fasces. I went to Royal Holloway as head of planning.
That is a bit of a handbrake term, isn't it?
Yeah. And that was very interesting. And I liked Royal Holloway a lot. I'm still in touch with a lot of people from there. And then while I was there, I ended up being given the governance role as well, which is there is a rational segue at some point here. And then when I left there, I went to Sussex and I was the director of planning there. And after 3 months there, I was given governance because I'd done it before. So in the course of my time at Sussex, I decided that actually I was more interested in governance than planning. So I had a And also I thought I'd have a change from research intensive institutions. So I moved over to the post-92 sector, and I was secretary first at the University of East London, and then I moved to Greenwich, and then I moved to the LSE in 2017. So it's my third secretary role, but they're all very different. I mean, you know, anyone who's moved in HE knows that you sort of think, oh, I know a university works. You know, it's pretty samey, and they're not. They're all so totally different because of the culture and the people and the pressing issues. But I mean, I have worked for 14 vice chancellors. So I either look very fickle or they do. So, you know, you can draw your own conclusions.
So that's over the course of
my career.
That career, yeah. You just described.
Yeah. I'm on my 14th.
Oh, I'm just thinking I've never counted them up, and I will do
you
that
should.
Later.
It's a good
game. I
will
do that later. Let's just going back to the sudden switch to governance then, right? So you acquired governance, as people often do, as a kind of addition to a portfolio when you were doing strategy and planning, and that happened at Royal Holloway, and then also at Sussex. I mean, is there a part of you that thinks it's just the thing that no one else wanted to do, or is it something that actually, which it's not what I think, I should stress, but it's one of those things that that people just regard it as difficult and unusual and somehow different from everything else, that unless you've done it before, you don't know what you're doing. So it's because it does have a mystique about it, doesn't it?
Yes, I know what you mean. I think some people regard it as a mystique, and others as a kind of incredibly dry bureaucratic exercise that only really dull people would do. Whereas I don't think it is. I think it's a very kind of facilitative activity, actually, and it more than oils the wheels. But I think at Royal Holloway, I got it because there was a retirement, and frankly, they were saving on a post. So that was a restructuring consequence. And at Sussex, somebody was let go and the same thing kind of happened. So in that sense, yes, no one else did want to do it, I suppose. But I actually think there's quite a nice kind of nexus between the strategy planning and governance angles. I think somebody told me once, and I've no idea if this is strictly true, that I was the first person to have that kind of combined role and to appoint dedicated governance staff. I didn't know that, they did, but I mean, I don't know if that's strictly true. So I think there was a bit more of an emerging pattern of those roles being more closely linked. You know, I think there is that kind of connection between sort of strategy and performance and risk, and that therefore needs the overarching arm of governance in order to, you know, make sure that there is proper accountability and transparency for what happens. And it is, to me, governance is a strategic tool. So I think in moving more into a dedicated governance role, those things were actually a very helpful underpinning in hopefully being a better secretary.
I think that's a really good point. And your point about the linkage with risk and planning, I think is also a very important one. But I think that is a relatively recent, in universities at least, a relatively recent phenomenon. So your colleague who said that you may have been the first, maybe absolutely right. Because governance as a term is also, I think, relatively recent in the context of universities, and it was only ever really used in relation to, you know, governing bodies rather than the generality of governance operations within the university. So I think its usage has changed quite a lot in recent years, for sure.
Well, as you say, I think as well that there's a greater and probably healthier emphasis on accountability for things, whether that's kind of financial, in our obligations to students, in our various stakeholders, and dare I say it, to the regulator as well. And that's not just in a kind of tick boxy compliance sense. I think it goes a bit deeper than that. So I think it has a more I think you're right. I think people just used to think of it as governing body. And I'm sometimes a little bit uncomfortable at the LSE because I think governance is used in a very generic term as a very generic term, when often what it really means is ways of organizing ourselves. Now, to me, that's only one small dimension of governance. And so I slightly have a nervous tick inside when people refer to that at the school, because I mean, it does go much more broadly than the governing body, but I think it's sometimes not always understood. But that's part of the character of the school, and you run with it, you know. So,
I don't think it's just at the LSE. I think you're right. I think there is, as it's grown in its usage, right? People deploy it all over the place, essentially, and it's come to almost mean anything vaguely formal.
Yes.
In university life, you know, and yes. people do tick the box, right? Have we got terms of reference for this committee? Tick, governance, right? And it's as simple as that. And there are an awful lot more people with governance in their job title now than there were when you were first taking on those roles.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think in the way that, you know, I would never go as far as to suggest it's sexy, but it is much more omnipresent, I suppose, which is a good thing. But I think one of the areas that is a real issue of struggle is, and I know we're certainly not alone in this, is meaningful academic governance, accountability, and how that's reflected through what your governing body has to do. And again, it's not a misused term, academic governance, but no one really knows what it means. It's a real challenge, I think, that.
Well, let me just come back to the is governance sexy question first, because I think that's quite.
Am I the first person who's got the word sexy in one of your podcasts?
You are. Yes, absolutely. You've now repeated it as well, as well as drawing attention to. But I mean, I think there is a sense, and I wouldn't use the adjective, right? But there is a sense in which. The key issues of top level governance, right, around the governing body and such like, right, are in reality in universities so little understood because so few people are exposed to them, right? Mm. They have a perception of what happens in the, you know, in the closeted environs of the governing body, but it is only a perception, and actually so few people see it and experience it. And, you know, we are, as secretaries to governing body, are privileged to see it, and have seen lots over the years. You've seen three different institutions, but you know an awful lot more than just about anyone else in the institution about what happens in there. All right. And apart from your, you know, your principals and your vice chancellors and whatever, there aren't many people who see it. Right. And I think that's maybe not, you know, but it's interesting in the fact that it's quite a closeted small world.
Mm. No, I agree with that. I think, you know, it's reflected in the kind of, you know, the fact that really it's only the head of institution and the secretary who are appointed by the governing body. There is this sort of this sort of almost holy relationship. So I agree. I think it is very different. And I think I know what you mean. It is a sort of privilege, and they're never the same. So I think you don't, you might grow a little weary at times, but you certainly don't grow cynical about it, because they're never, you know, they're kind of strange living entities, and they're dealing with sort of privileged material. And I'm sure it'll be exactly the same at Nottingham, but, you know, people are just, you can tell they're really thrilled to be on the governing body, you know, but sometimes the material is really difficult for them. And I think one of the ongoing challenges of people in our positions is how do you make that translatable, and how do you make sure that you get the best out of the people you've selected for a reason, and that they actually, it sounds wrong, but to say they understand why they're there beyond just a kind of ticking box kind of compliance.
Completely agree. And I think that where I've seen, you know, members of our council behaving in the most and contributing in the most effective way, it's been where they've got developed, usually over a period of time, a real understanding about what the university is about. Right. And they've got a kind of sense beyond the papers and beyond the walls of the room what actually makes you know, an academic tick. You know, what is the priorities of the academic heartlands and where students are coming from? Because, okay, you can only ever get a narrow slice of that, a bit of a perception. But if you haven't got that, then it's really difficult to make a serious contribution, I think, to some of the big strategic questions that governing bodies are required to face. You've got to understand the nature of a university and, you know, how life works in a university environment and the priorities of the university's very diverse and different communities, it seems to me.
I absolutely agree. And I think it's one of the challenges, I think, is carving out enough time for the governing body to be able to do that meaningfully, because particularly in the current regulatory context, there are so many things to funnel up to the governing body, which are just, you know, regulatory requirements, and they're very important. But it makes it very difficult to sort of carve out the time. And I think a lot of the business we do, I say we as a sector, is looking at things like, you know, well, can we balance our books? What's the money looking like? Can we afford that building? You know, what our student numbers going to be? They're very kind of input driven, really, I suppose. And I think to get that sort of qualitative, meaningful sort of relationship with the academic enterprise is sometimes really quite difficult. And sometimes because it's more nuanced, it's often less specific, I suppose. It's then really difficult to get people to engage with that meaningfully when there isn't a deadline against signing off the financial statements or you know, or getting the ref in. It's a real mixed bag for them. I don't think being an independent member of a governing body is an easy job to really engage with it. And of course, you know, everyone's conscious, oh, they're busy, you know, they give a lot of their time gratis. What is reasonable? But I think, you know, presumably, I always think people want to be on governing bodies because they are interested in educational matters and they're interested in universities, not just because they want to look at someone's finances or get their name on a new building. You know, it's trying to get that balanced engagement with them, really.
Let me go back to the issue you raised earlier of academic governance, because I think that's an underexplored area. So just say a little bit more about how you're interpreting that term.
I think it's really about how governing bodies or anyone can be assured of the quality of our academic offering and that all those kind of necessary measures about you know, the degrees we offer, degree inflation, where all those kind of decisions are made, yeah. That there's a transparent understanding of it and what those kind of key factors are that assure the quality of academic provision and that they are sound, even if they're not perfect. I think that the challenge of it is it's so vast and it's such a specialist area in many ways. You need to have a really good understanding of some of the matters to really know what to look for. And I think this is probably where one's staff and student members can play a key part in facilitating that understanding. But, you know, I'm not sure members of governing bodies, if you held a gun to their head, would be able to explain how they knew that the quality of the academic output was good.
Yeah.
How was it measured? Where were the decisions made? How would they know if something was going wrong? You know, league tables, TEF, they're blunt instruments. They don't always tell you a lot. I think it's very difficult.
Because the historical position would be that they would say that, well, that's what we delegate to the Senate or equivalent, right? And we expect, and they wouldn't put it this way, though, but we expect that those academic structures and the professionalism and know-how of those academic staff that the university appoints to do all this stuff would, together with their procedures around external examiners and final degree classification, all the rest of it, would actually assure everyone that the standard of the awards issued in our name and the quality of the education provided, and we take it on trust. Of course, yes. In England, that is no longer acceptable because the Office for Students demands that they sign off on that. So, which is hard for them, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is. And of course, I think, you know, all the uncertainty about the DQB doesn't help either in terms of helping us to navigate our way through. And I think there are certain things as well around the structures within universities which can help or hinder in that sense. I'm talking about, you know, the kind of committee architecture and things like that, which, you know, are variable. As you say, it's the Senate or the academic board that's supposed to have oversight of these decisions. But, you know, our academic board is a quite a quaint thing. I'm not sure that it always absolutely delivers that in a way that our governing body can understand. So I think
Yeah,
it's really difficult.
the understanding bit is important because the language is very different in the academic community from the that typically experienced by your external governing body members.
Yeah.
But the other element of this is that that academic board or Senate equivalent may of course also think that it's got interests that go well beyond the meat and potatoes of quality assurance and research performance, and think that
Yeah.
actually it should be dictating everything that goes on in the university. Because that
Yeah.
is another analysis of academic governance, isn't it? It's academic
Absolutely.
dominance of the governance process.
Absolutely. And certainly, when I was at Sussex, that was very much the belief. You know, the perception there was that academic board was the university's parliament. It was a senate there actually, and it was quite legitimate to bring any matter on any topic that was of interest to the academic community, and the meetings there were like nothing I've ever seen before or since. And they were, yeah, they were kind of in a way that you always learn more from things that are difficult and don't go well. I learned a lot through that sort of experience, and I think there's still that view still pervades in some institutions. Certainly, I've worked at places where academic board is unbelievably tame, and it's not a bad thing, by the way. And they have sort of sensible discussions, and it isn't controversial. Whereas, you know, at the LSE, the academic board is 1,000 members strong. So, it's like somebody once likened it to like being some kind of key organ of the Chinese Communist Party in terms of the scale and proportion of its operations. So that can be a challenge in itself. In reality, of course, 1,000 people don't come, but you know, that's the purpose of it. It's something that's there for everyone, and that's very difficult, I suppose. Even if you think that's a good principle, that doesn't fit very easily with current expectations around academic governance delivery, students as consumers, the regulators' requirements, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the bureaucrat in me overtakes the purist. They are difficult bodies. I don't know how it works at Nottingham, whether you have oversight of academic board, but that also sits within my area. And you know, it's a really good connection for some of my team to academic activity and to a range of academic colleagues. But it's not always easy. It's always
Yeah.
unexpected, let's put it that way.
Undoubtedly, yeah. And I think that there's a very wide range of experiences of those bodies. And obviously if all your 1,000 turned up, you wouldn't have a room big enough for them,
Well, it's
presumably,
all
if
on
they're
Zoom now, which
oh, it's
makes it
all
a
on
lot
Zoom,
easier.
right? Okay. No, even more fun. Even more fun. Well, I mean, the thing that is different, I mean, going back to your experiences at Greenwich and East London, I mean, the post-92 structure is very, very different, isn't it? And your board of governors is much smaller and tighter, presumably, in both of those institutions, and your academic board as well, much smaller than your typical, Russell Group.
I mean, actually, although they both had, you know, well, I think actually at Greenwich there's a court, at UEL there's a board. They weren't kind of corporate board size by any means, but they were under 20, if that's considered small these days. but they were certainly, and obviously they had staff representation as well, but they were, often they had more difficult things to look at in terms of huge levels of financial challenge. Certainly at UEL, a lot of turbulence, and yet actually it was an easier, the issues were harder, but the nature of the conversation was easier, I suppose. It was sort of less political with a with a big and a small P. And you're right, I think the academic boards were the same, slightly different at Greenwich, which is a bit more of a hybrid institution, I suppose. But it was, yeah, I mean, good, robust conversations. But I think, you know, I've reflected on it since and thought, well, there's things that I did at Greenwich that were a lot quicker and easier than things I've had to think about more at the LSE. I mean, I think one thing that has sort of surprised me is that every time I've moved, and as I said, I've moved a lot, you sort of expect that where you're going to will have done a lot of what you've had to do in the previous role. And I'm always, you know, possibly naive in being surprised that actually I've arrived and thought, oh my God, do you not do that? You know, in a kind of amazed way. How is it, whatever year it is, and you've not done this yet? Because you just think, how are you functioning? So often often you end up doing really surprising things. But you just think, but you know, you're a really well-respected institution. Why are you doing it like this? Why haven't you modernized? Why haven't you done this? How do you allow this to go on? So, you know, that's some of the paradoxes, I think. Because, of course, places do function. They're fine before I arrive and they're fine when I leave. But it's a consistent shock.
Yeah, despite the transformative effect you have between those two those 2 days, but I mean I think it's a really good point, Louis, because you know universities of all types are, you know, even the small ones are actually quite large organisations and are very diverse, but and also complex. Have, you know, lots of people flowing in and out of them, and the priorities are always different, right? So it is understandable in a way that, with, you know, given that we're all autonomous institutions, that institutions do choose to do things differently. And it's perhaps just a coincidence that none of them have done all the things that you would expected of them when you arrived. I mean, yeah. it's a vote in favour of freedom of choice, but you know, it must be a bit tedious in terms of your repetition. At least you know what to do when you arrive there.
No, the irony is it's always different what they haven't done. So yes, I mean, given that, you know, one of the reasons I've moved a lot is in order to get new experience, you know, to try something new. Yeah. It's certainly been very, very, very developmental. Although there's always a surprise that you sort of don't always expect to be doing what you end up doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it is reflective in the way I said before that, you know, you go to a place and you think, you know, what a university is about. Everything is different. It's kind of the same problems broadly, but with different levels of granularity and certainly different approaches to resolving them and massively different cultures. So I think one of the interesting things about having moved a lot in the sector is adapting to that and having to kind of test the pace of change that's acceptable to that institution. Because I'm naturally impatient. I'd like to be able to do things quickly, but, you know, one thing I've really learned, I think, through being a secretary in 3 different places is the power of patience sometimes, and just taking a little bit longer to do another round of consultation. And that sometimes those sort of extension periods are a time so well spent, because you get a smoother ride when you actually get to the critical point. I think that's part of the interest, and the fact that when you arrive and something is really surprising and seems very archaic, sometimes trying to change that is a real test of the kind of the appetite for change that there is in a place, and you have to read that in order to make it a success.
I think that is a really good point. And the other thing, of course, it may be that actually, you know, you run the risk of being distracted by that particular anomaly which doesn't really matter that much.
Mm.
And you don't notice the great big nightmare over there, which you really should be addressing in your role, because it's easy to fix those little things that just annoy you.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's I think you have to have a good sense of proportionality, really, what is really going to help and make a difference. And I think the nature of secretary type roles is that it's one of the reasons why I kind of strayed into this kind of work and have stayed, I suppose, is because it's the variety that there is. Yeah. So, I really like that. It's anything but staid and dull, and it's not all sitting around the governing body table. You know, it's that there's a lot of things that part of the benefit, obviously, of being on the executive team that you're involved in as well. So I think they're really scopey roles, but that gives you a better oversight, I think, for how bits of the jigsaw fit together, so that you can work on the governance angle of everything, really. And you're a key part in, you know, I see that the essence of my job is protecting the institution. So that's always the kind of uppermost thought in the sense of any action that you're going to take.
That's protecting the institution both from external intervention and from itself.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Let me come on to this external intervention then, because we're running out of time, but there's a couple more things I just want to ask. But I mean, looking at the external landscape, right, there are a whole bunch of things coming rapidly towards institutions, which, you know, will impact on all of us, but will impact on governance as well. So of all the things that you see, you know, rushing towards you that fill you with horror, what do you think is the biggest and most difficult or the most awkward or the most challenging thing that universities and colleges are going to have to grapple with in the months and years ahead?
Well, I hate to say it, really, but I think, you know, I can only see a continuation of the industrial action situation, really. One of the things I've been very caught up on in the last, 9 to 12 months is around the impact on students and the student contract. So I think the whole issue of fee refunds and consumer expectations is only going to get more profound. Something else is spent quite a lot of time concerned about is not so much the free speech bill in and of itself, although I think it's a flawed piece of rushed legislation, but around the kind of controversies that can light up the campus that are external influences. And I think there's a really important element of that about, you know, what a university is really for. And how it should function. And some of those kind of principled aspects, I think, are under real challenge at the moment. And it's a difficult path to navigate through. So I think there are reputational issues there, certainly.
That issue around free speech, and I agree with you. I mean, it's hugely problematic in all sorts of ways. But all of those issues are magnified by, you know, by the you know, salacious interest of media and social media and what things that used to be at the margins of university life but now seem, you know, really interesting and sell papers, you know. So I mean, in the past few days we've seen, for example, you know, the what I've seen hundreds of times, like feels over the years, is a students' union, in this case at Cambridge, having a vote on what food it wants to, you know, wants to see in the restaurants and what it doesn't, you know, expressing an opinion on that, as students' unions have done since time immemorial, right? So it's blown out of all proportion. And but these are, you know, suddenly held up as issues around freedom and around choice, whereas actually it's nothing of the kind. It's just a students' union expressing a view, as they always do, which they're entitled to.
I think a lot of it is, well, you know, we're in a very sort of politically hostile environment with universities generally, aren't we? I mean, maybe not so much as in the last year or so, but you know, we're easy targets, aren't we? And certainly you know, our past constantly comes back to haunt us in the media, with kind of, you know, long ancient stories, really. So it's quite tricky. Certainly, I think, you know, being a kind of person in charge of university PR or external relations at the moment has a very difficult job. But, you know, it's only going to go on, so we may as well get used to it, I suppose.
So things that go on then, final question then, Louise, if I may, which is that, you know, having been around all these different institutions in the sector, and we've already acknowledged we're a strange and diverse set of organisations, is there something that is particularly odd or strange or weird or amusing that you you can share with me?
I think it's something I've probably hinted at before a little bit when we were talking about senates and academic boards. I'm always kind of a little bit taken aback, I suppose, that you have extremely able academic colleagues who are interested in pushing back the frontiers of knowledge and are quite iconoclastic potentially about what's gone before them, and yet you try and change a small part of their home environment in their own institution, and they're very, very change resistant. So, you know, I've having worked at a particular medical school, I will never quite forget the conversation. The biggest argument there ever was at the academic board was around car parking. There were only 5 spaces for staff, so I mean, it didn't even matter to most people. And the name of the institution. There was a near riot. A name is slightly different. The car parking was made no sense, but the name, I appreciate that's a kind of, yeah, people feel a very strong personal affiliation. But there have been some very, very strange things to do with small changes to the domestic university environment, and that seems a bridge too far. And yet these people are changing the way we live. So it's part of the charm of the sector, I suppose, as well as one of its kind of idiosyncrasies. But that's probably what's kept me in, to be honest, that kind of stuff.
5 car parking spaces really isn't many. Louise, we need to stop there. But listen, thanks ever so much for your time. It's been a lovely conversation. And I think you've done a great service to governance in our institutions. So thank you.
You're very kind. Thank you.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.